And we are delighted to have as our lecturer tonight Bishop Michael Nasser Ali. Michael was born in Pakistan and has dual citizenships of Pakistan and Britain. He was a bishop in the West Punjab before he came to England, and then he was the General Secretary of the Church Mission Society. A number of bishops have gone through that post, including our own Bishop of Winchester. This was the job he had before he became Bishop of Winchester. Michael went on to be Bishop of Rochester and would have gone to a higher rank still had political factors not intervened, but we won't go into that sorry saga. Michael has led, at a high level, dialogues between Christians and Muslims. And now freed of his diocesan responsibilities, he writes and researches and teaches for various theological faculties in his role as director of the Oxford Centre for Training, Research, Advocacy and Dialogue. And after his lecture tonight, we will have an extended time of dialogue in the form of your questions and Michael's answers. And I'll be grateful if we keep it that way round. And after which we will have at some due point where we will discern we should retreat for refreshments and the bookstall. And we're very grateful to the Bournemouth bookshop, Keith Jones, for providing our book table again. It adds a tremendous extra value to these lectures now that it's really quite so difficult to get hold of a good range of Christian books. So Adrian is the man, and he has got a card machine if you haven't got cash, but he's got a good display of books, including Michael's books, and we'll look at those later on just before we break for after the question time. So I think without further ado, Michael's got to get back to Kent tonight, so I don't think we should waste any of his time at all. So give me a warm welcome with me to Michael.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. It's always a good thing to have applause before someone has spoken, because, of course, there may be none afterwards. And it's interesting how one comes to the same place twice in succession. I've always wondered about this. You know, you go to a parish, and then a few weeks later, something terrible happens, and you're in the parish again. Well, I hope this won't happen tonight, but... I was here actually a few days ago to do a television program at the King Edward School. Nearly missed the program because I thought the program was at the BBC Centre, and then had to double back, got there just in the nick of time. And the topic then was refugees and Sunday shopping and whether there were sins that were unforgivable. Well, we won't go into those tonight, but it's good to be in Southampton again in a more relaxed way. With more time, hopefully, that I can give to my subject. Well, I think Peter has hinted already at the urgency of the topic tonight. One of the facts is that Christians and Muslims now find themselves cheek by jowl in many different countries, contexts, cultures. And this is because Christianity and Islam are the two great missionary religions of our time. Whatever else we say, that is how it is. And so it is very important for Christians and Muslims to learn about one another. That is what dialogue should be about. To work together where they can. And to understand one another, I think, most importantly of all. And in this, we have a very long story of encounter, of conflict, of dialogue, of cooperation. And that's the story I want to tell you tonight with some of the issues that arise from that story. Some are positive things that arise and some negative. So there has never been a time since the rise of Islam as a religion, when Christians, Jews, and Muslims have not been living together. Never been a time. Even before Muhammad, the Prophet of Islam, began his work, he had very probably been to the holy, then holy, Christian countries of Syria and of Mesopotamia in the cause of trade. He was employed by an older woman, and who sent him for trading reasons to these various places. And there are echoes of some of this knowledge of Christian churches, for instance, or even of Christian clergy in the Quran itself and in the prophets, in the stories about his life. When he eventually married the woman who was much older than him, who had been his employer, as long as she remained alive, he did not marry anyone else. So it was a monogamous marriage. And this has led some people to ask whether Khadija, his first wife, was a Christian and whether this was Christian marriage. Well, whether it was or not, she certainly had Christian relatives who are mentioned with great honor in the Islamic tradition, from whom Muhammad learned a very great deal about Judaism and Christianity. When he began his preaching of a pure monotheism in the city of Mecca, he aroused a great deal of opposition amongst the citizens of that city, because the city was a center for the cults of the daughters of Allah. The pagan Arabs believed that Allah had three daughters, Al-Lat, Al-Manat, and Al-Uzza. And Mecca was a center, Mecca and its environs were a center for the cult of these daughters of Allah. So naturally, Muhammad, the Prophet of Islam's preaching of a pure monotheism, militated against these cults. Well, what does that remind Christians of? It reminds me very strongly of the riot at Ephesus. You remember where the silversmiths making little statues of Artemis or Diana of the Ephesians were threatened by St. Paul's preaching of the gospel. It was a bit like that. And Muhammad himself was protected by family connections. But some of his other, at that time, very few followers were not. So they came under increasing pressure and persecution from the pagan Meccans, whose cults they were threatening. So what did Muhammad do? He sent them out as refugees. He sent them into exile as refugees. And where did he send them? He sent them to the Christian kingdom or empire, as it then was, of Abyssinia or Ethiopia, as it is now called. When these refugees arrived, they were interrogated by immigration officials. Well, that's the lot of refugees, isn't it? To be interviewed by immigration officials. That happens today, it happened then. But this was theological interrogation. The representatives of the Abyssinian Negus, or emperor, wanted to know what these Muslims believed about Jesus and his mother Mary. And they told these officials that their prophet had taught them that Jesus was Word and Spirit of God and had been born of a pure virgin. See, this is all from Islamic tradition. On that basis, they were given refuge in Ethiopia. I was in Ethiopia actually about a year ago to deliver some lectures, as it happens. And I met a very interesting group of Muslims there called the Habash, who claimed to be descendants of those refugees. And they told me that because they had been given refuge in Ethiopia at that time, jihad was never lawful against Ethiopia. Well, that was an interesting thing to hear at the time from them. because, of course, there are other sorts of people who believe other things. Eventually, Muhammad himself had to leave Mecca, and he went to the city of Yathrib, which later on came to be called Medina. And there he became not only the spiritual ruler, but he also became the temporal ruler of the people who had invited him and those who had come along with him. Some of the refugees from Ethiopia also returned, although some, as I've just said, never did return. When he became ruler of Medina, he promulgated something called the Sahifat al-Madina, the Constitution of Medina. Medina at that time was a very mixed city of course, the newly arrived Muslims, those who had become Muslim in Medina, a very large number of Jews, of Jewish tribes, Judaized tribes, both in the city and around it, and of course the pagan Arabs and some Christians. The Constitution of Medina prescribes equal rights and duties for all the inhabitants of Medina. Certain duties that they owe the city and certain rights that they have by virtue of being citizens of Medina. Now, I say this because this is the constitution of the first Islamic state. So when people say to me, as they do when I go here or there, that they want to have an Islamic state, I say to them, will it be like the first one? And if not, why not? And this is a question worth pondering. But it is true that this state of affairs did not last. Muhammad and his followers became increasingly suspicious, particularly of the Jews in Medina, that they were collaborating with the Meccans, who had not given up on getting rid of Muhammad. And so two very influential Jewish tribes, the Banu Nadir and the Banu Kanuka, were stripped of their possessions and exiled. The third, the largest and the best armed, a siege was laid to them, the Banu Qurayza. And when they surrendered, eventually, their males, the men were all beheaded. The slaughter took a whole day, and the women and children were sold into slavery. Now, I'm not just saying this. I'm saying this because this is important also for what happens in the future. This was, however, not the only thing that happened, because, for instance, Muhammad invited the Christians of the state of Najran. Najran is again in the news because it is right on the border between Yemen and Saudi Arabia and is so catching quite a lot of the conflict that's going on there. But that was a Christian state at the time. And Muhammad invited its rulers and its clergy to conclude a treaty with him. So they were invited to Medina and they were lodged in the Prophet's mosque whilst the negotiations were going on. Islamic tradition tells us they were allowed to perform the divine liturgy in the Prophet's mosque whilst they were staying there. Now again, this is not just of historical interest, because today, if you go to Saudi Arabia and attempt to go towards Mecca or Medina, you will be met by large notices saying that if you're not a Muslim, you go past those notices at the risk of your life. But that was not the Prophet of Islam's own practice. I mean, that's the point that is worth making. Again, these negotiations were preceded by theological dialogue. So the Christians of Najran wanted to know what Muhammad believed about Jesus. And again, he said that he believed Jesus was Word and Spirit of God, a messenger from God, a prophet of God, and so on. But the Christians of Najran were not so easily put off. They said, yes, but is he the Son of God? Now, you will remember that the Prophet of Islam had already denied that Allah could have daughters. That is what caused the trouble in Mecca. So now how could he say that God had a son? So he said, no, he's not God's son. That, of course, has become paradigmatic for what Muslims believe about Jesus. The Christians of Najran then said, well, whose son is he? If you say that he was born of a virgin, whose son is he? What shall we call him? As you know, in the Arabic language, people are called by the name of their father. So Osama bin Laden, Osama, who is the son of Laden, or Aziz bin Saud, Aziz, who's the son of Saud, and so on. So what shall we say about Jesus, they said? Who's his father? Now, the Sunnah of the Prophet of Islam tells us that he didn't give any reply to the Christians of Najran at that time. But in the Quran, there are two answers to this Christian question. One is that he is Isa ibn Maryam. He is Jesus, the son of Mary. This was a title of disrespect in the context of Jewish Christian polemic, of course, questioning the legitimacy of Jesus. But in Islam, to give it its due, it becomes a title of honor, a way of indicating that Jesus had a unique birth. The other answer was a counter question, which was, well, whose son was Adam? So just as God had created Adam out of clay, so he'd breathed his word into Mary and Jesus was born. Well, that may be true. However, there is one difference about Adam and Jesus in the Quran itself, because although Adam is created by God's creative word, kun fayakunu, Adam is never called the Word of God, which Jesus undoubtedly is. So that may be a difference worth noting. In spite of there being not complete agreement, theological agreement, a treaty was concluded with the Christians of Najran. They went back, and as long as Muhammad was alive, that treaty was respected. The Muslim armies also laid siege to the Jewish fortress of the Khaybar. This was a prosperous agricultural community, very large agricultural community. They surrendered. This time, they were neither exiled nor killed. But a treaty was concluded with them such that they could continue with their work of agriculture, growing very fine dates, for instance. But they had to pay half of their produce as a tribute to the Muslims. So you see, you've got different models emerging of exile, of elimination, of treaty, of tribute. All of these are relevant in the story that is to follow in the centuries to come. Very quickly, after Muhammad, the Prophet of Islam's death, Islam expanded into what was then almost wholly the Christian Middle East. You know, this is something we must never forget, that the center of the Christian world up to that time and for some time after was the Middle East. All the great Christian cities were there: Damascus, Jerusalem, Alexandria, Constantinople, Edessa. I mean, some have disappeared or nearly disappeared. In the West, we had Rome, but that was about it. Now, Islam expanded into this Christian, Jewish Christian world, and then further into what was then the Persian Empire. The Persians and the Byzantines had exhausted each other by their incessant fighting. And this is one reason why the Arab Muslim armies were so able to conquer both the Christian territories and the territories of the Persian Empire. Sometimes these cities were surrendered peacefully. Damascus, the gates of Damascus were opened for the Muslim armies by the family Al-Mansur, a distinguished Christian family, because the Byzantine garrison had deserted the city. There was no other option. And of course, Al-Mansur is the family from which the great St. John of Damascus came. Perhaps the greatest theologian of the Eastern Church ever. The day of resurrection, earth tell it out abroad. We sing sometimes at Easter his hymn still. In other places, there was treachery. Egypt was lost because of the treachery of the clergy. Jerusalem was surrendered to preserve the holy places. You know, each place has its own story. There are certain things that happened at this time and in the years to follow that are worth noting because of their relevance to us today. The first is that just as the Banu Qurayza, you remember them, what happened to them? Just as they were liquidated, so there was the destruction of a number of Christian, Zoroastrian, and Jewish communities as Islam expanded. I think this has to be recognized. The great general who led the expansion at the time was a man called Khalid bin Walid, celebrated as a hero still, and was a very brave general, but very cruel, to the extent that his own soldiers reported him for cruelty, and he was lightly disciplined by the first caliph, Abu Bakr, who took over from Muhammad. But when the second caliph, Umar, became the caliph, he deprived Khalid bin Walid of all command because of what he thought was unnecessary cruelty in the conduct of his campaigns. So there was this destruction. There was also the dispersal of communities, people being removed from their natural habitat. You remember the Christians of Najran and the Jews of the Khyber. Well, there was now a prophetic tradition discovered which said that the Jews and the Christians should be expelled from Peninsular Arabia. You see. So what happened? Where did they go? The Christians went to Iraq, and the Jews went to Jericho. You see. last year, the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia delivered a fatwa that no churches can be built on the Arabian Peninsula. You see, so what happened then is still relevant today. Of course, there are no churches in Saudi Arabia. I once asked a senior Saudi official about this, and he said, but there are no mosques in the Vatican. I mean, that was his answer. But of course, that's true. But there are churches in the other states on the peninsula, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Bahrain, and so on. So what will this fatwa do to those churches? People were dispersed. A system of discrimination was set in place. And I use those words advisedly. It was systemic. This wasn't just discrimination that happened. The dhimma was created. So Jews and Christians at first, later Zoroastrians, were allowed to live in the Islamic domains provided they accepted certain conditions. One was that they would pay a tax, an extra tax, to the rulers called the jizya. and that this tax would be paid in such a way as revealed their subdued or inferior status. So typically, the man receiving the tax would give a symbolic blow on the neck to the person paying the tax to show that this person was a subject of those who were ruling. They couldn't, of course, serve in the armed forces or in the civil service. They could keep their churches or synagogues, but they could repair them only with permission. And no new churches or synagogues could be built. So much of the conflict, for example, in Egypt, when we see on television churches being burned, this is because the Christians have tried to build a church. I asked a senior Iranian official a few years ago how many churches had been built in Iran since the Islamic Revolution, and he said, none, the Christians don't need them. So I said, how do you know? Have you asked them? Well, we don't know the answer to that. Christians could not ride, and Jews could not ride horses. They could ride donkeys. They had sometimes to wear a special dress, and so on. You know, there were various disabilities associated with the dhimma, which reduced these people to being subjects rather than citizens of the states in which they live. Now, the dhimma, in one way you could say, was a way of accommodating people who were different. And in those days, this was the way to do it. Well, maybe one can understand that argument. The problem is that there are people today wanting a reinstitution of the dhimma and have actually succeeded in some parts of the world, at least partially, to bring in the dhimma again. This was one of the conflicts in the last few years in Egypt between those who wanted co-citizenship and those who wanted a dhimma like Egypt. It has happened already in Iran, to some extent in Pakistan, and other places. In spite of this systemic discrimination, the Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians played a huge role in the emergence of what has come to be called Islamic civilization. You know, you see exhibitions, don't you, of Islamic art or Islamic manuscripts or whatever. Well, yes, the question is, how did these people from the desert quite quickly develop this incredible material, intellectual, and artistic civilization? And part of the answer is that they wanted to, of course, but they could not have done so without these subject peoples, who were, of course, for many centuries, in some parts, the majority of the population. So in Egypt, the Christian population fell below 50% only in about the 14th century. There are many different aspects to this. Systems of government were sometimes borrowed from the Persian Empire, the pre-Islamic Persian Empire. A mosque is really an adaptation of the Eastern Church. And of course, many Eastern churches were converted into mosques, like the Cathedral Mosque in Damascus, which used to be the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist. And his head is allegedly still there, a shrine that is revered by both Christians and Muslims. But one example of this contribution was the way in which Greek learning, philosophy, medicine, science, was translated and transmitted to the Arabs. Now, we hear very often in Western universities, I'm not sure about Southampton, how the West received the riches of Hellenistic learning from the Arab world. That is true, they did. But the prior question is not so often asked, which is, how did the Arabs get it? And the answer is the Arabs got it, the Muslim Arabs got it, mainly through the work of Christian clergy. I mean, the clergy do have their uses sometimes. The Abbasid caliphs had established translation schools for this work, which were staffed almost wholly by Christian clergy. Just to give you one example, a father and son team, Hunan ibn Ishaq and Ishaq ibn Hunan, they're both Nestorian Christians, they, between them, translated the whole of the Greek medical corpus into Arabic. The father knew better Greek, so he translated from Greek into Syriac, which is, of course, a wholly Christian language. The son knew better Arabic, so he translated from Syriac into Arabic. When this was transmitted to the West, it became the basis for the medical syllabus in many Western universities, and I was told on good authority that it remained the basis for the teaching of medicine in Oxford up to the 18th century. How did the West get it? Well, it got it really in two main ways. One, through Jewish traders, who sometimes attempted good or not so good translations into Latin, for instance. And this can be seen by the way in which Arabic names are found in an Hebraic form. So Ibn Rushd, the great philosopher and jurist, is called what in Western languages? Averroes. You know what happens to the B and the V in Hebrew. Ibn Avicenna, Ibn Sina becomes Avicenna, and so on. You look them up, you'll see it almost inevitable that this will happen. Secondly, they got it through the Arabic-speaking Christian communities of the West. Where were they? In Spain and Portugal, in the Iberian Peninsula. These were the so-called Mustarabs, the Arabized people, Arabized Christians, who were then able to transmit this learning to other monasteries, particularly at first, and then universities in Western Europe. So that's how it happened. Now, this feast of reason and flow of soul, as it were, was interrupted. Well, it was continually being interrupted, actually, but there were two major catastrophes that occurred, which have to be mentioned. At this point. Throughout these centuries, what we call the Middle Ages, people from Central Asia had been coming into the Middle East, into parts of Europe and into India, and settling. Some of them became Muslim, some of them began to even to take power from the Arabs in the Muslim world. But there was one arrival that was most catastrophic of all, and that was the arrival of the Mongols. When the Mongols arrived, they caused the kind of devastation that the civilized world had never seen before. A destruction of cities, massacres of populations, and the destruction of civilization, really. In 1258, the Mongols conquered Baghdad, the capital of the Islamic world at the time, and completely destroyed it. The Arab historian Ibn Athir says that he wished he had never been born than to have seen what he saw. And the Persian poet Saadi, who is currently a favorite of the Islamic revolutionary government in Iran, says, "Muhammad, if you are to come on Judgment Day, come now, because this is Judgment Day." Such was the extent of the destruction. But the destruction was not even. The Mongols had been in contact with Shia Islam somehow in their travels. And so they were not so hard on the Shia in Iraq. Some of the Mongol rulers had Nestorian Christian wives. So Baghdad was at that time the patriarchate, the center of the Church of the East, the Nestorian Church. So they escaped. But the brunt of the Mongol cruelty fell on the Sunnis. You see, again, I say this because we hear about Sunnis and Shias and Christians and Yazidis in Iraq today. All of this has a background, which we need to understand, of mutual suspicion and even hostility, why this is so. Anyway, that was one catastrophe. The other great event, of course, were the Crusades. And a great deal is written about the Crusades without really understanding why they happened and what they were. The Crusades, it seems to me, were called by Pope Urban II for three main reasons. One was that the newly converted Seljuk Turks, converted to Islam, were blocking the way of Western pilgrims to the Holy Land. I'm due there in a few days' time, and it's still quite difficult getting there. But this was something that we cannot imagine easily, because the Holy Land at that time was the fifth gospel. You understood the first four by going there, or sometimes creating it in your backyard, like Walsingham. This was catastrophic for Western Christians and the Western Church. Secondly, a Fatimi caliph from Egypt, who had lost his mental balance, I think it has to be said, completely destroyed, razed to the ground, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. He also then went on to destroy many Muslim places, holy places, but that's another story. Now again, this was alarming for Christians in the West to hear. But the third, and I think the most important reason, was that the Eastern Emperor, Alexius Comnenus, explicitly appealed to the Pope for help, because he was continually under pressure from Islam and was fearful that he would be overcome and Constantinople would be taken. So those were the three main reasons why the Crusades were called. This does not justify the behavior of the Crusaders. Some behaved very honorably, some did not. There was greed and cruelty. But this was not confined to one side. There was both chivalry and cruelty and greed on all sides. And there were people who, like Francis of Assisi, who were prepared to take a non-violent approach to Islam even then. One of the things that the modern Arab historian Amin Maalouf says about the Crusades is that arguably the people who suffered most were the Eastern Christians, because the Muslims regarded them as a fifth column, not to be trusted. And the Crusaders, of course, thought of them as heretics. So they got caught in between. One other point to make is that the Crusades were never conducted only against Muslims. There was a particularly horrible crusade against the Jews, and there was a crusade against Constantinople. The Latins took it and weakened it to such an extent that it is possible that when it fell in 1453, it was because it had been weakened by the Latin crusade. There was even talk of a crusade against Protestants, but nothing much came of that. The net effect of these disturbances was that power passed from the Arabs now to the Turks. and a little-known and very small Turkish tribe called the Othmanli began to rise and gradually established what we now know as the Ottoman Empire, the greatest, biggest empire in the Islamic world that has been known. It lasted a very long time, right up to modern times, right up to the end of the First World War, of course. And lots of things can be said about it, but one or two are relevant, so I'll concentrate on them. The first is that the Ottoman ruler eventually took the title of caliph. Now, in one sense, this is laughable, because the qualifications of a caliph were that he must be an Arab, not only an Arab, but he must belong to the tribe of the Quraysh, Muhammad's tribe, and so on. Well, sort of Johnny-come-lately Turk wasn't going to fulfill those qualifications. So how could he claim to be caliph? And the answer that was given was he could claim to be caliph because he was now the only Muslim ruler engaged in jihad. Where was he engaged in jihad? In southern and eastern Europe, of course, mainly. I think this is worth noting, the relationship between a claim to the caliphate and the conduct of jihad, for obvious reasons today. Secondly, the Ottomans, as their empire grew, they used a pre-Islamic Persian form of government called the millet system, which meant that they gave high levels of autonomy to particular religio-ethnic communities in the empire to conduct their own affairs, to have their own laws, as long as that didn't affect the business of the empire, to collect taxes and all of those things. Now, the reason I mention this is that wherever the Ottomans have ruled, this kind of consciousness of identity and autonomy of these communities is very high. So I was in Bosnia during the civil war there, and one of the reasons why Yugoslavia split in the way that it did so quickly after Tito's death was that, because of this consciousness of identity. Of course, it had been part of the Ottoman Empire. And there was never going to be any way of putting Humpty Dumpty together again. You know, that because these communities now wanted to affirm their identity, very often in religious terms, not always, but certainly in ethnic and territorial terms. This is also, by the way, the case with Iraq. Iraq could only be a unitary state under a very strong dictatorship like that of Saddam Hussein. Otherwise, at the very most, it can be a kind of confederal situation with high levels of autonomy, as some people like the Kurds already have. Well, we will see what happens. From about the middle of the 19th century, under terrific Western pressure, the Ottomans began to loosen the dhimma system. You remember the dhimma system where Christians and Jews were subjects rather than citizens. And the result of all of this in due course was that Christians and Jews found themselves for the first time since the rise of Islam to be fellow citizens with their Muslim compatriots. Now, the Jews, Zionism was already in the air. Zionism was an invention of Western European Jewry. But already Oriental Jews were being affected by it. And so their eyes were set on whatever Zionism might achieve. It was not always a return to the land. They considered, for example, setting up a Jewish homeland in South America at one time. But the Christians found themselves, first of all, as reluctant citizens, it has to be said. They'd got so used to the Vimma, so used to being subject peoples, that they didn't want the risk of independence, at least their leaders didn't. And this is one of the questions about the Dhimma, is whether it induces this kind of subject mentality in people. But gradually, as the Ottoman Empire began to break up, Greece attained independence as early as 1833, the Christians found themselves articulating various kinds of nationalist visions. And one of them, of course, was Arab nationalism. You see, so the thinking was that what made Arabs was their common language, their culture, their history, also to some extent the religion of Islam, but Islam was not the main thing. And the interesting thing about this is that the leading thinkers who framed this doctrine of Arab nationalism were Christians. Boutros Ghali, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, has just died. Well, his father was the Prime Minister of Egypt at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, that's almost impossible to imagine today. He was assassinated by a fanatic who didn't believe that a Christian should be Prime Minister of Egypt. But out of all proportion to their numbers, Christians were influential in this emergence of the Nahda of Arab nationalism, which of course became the polity of the modern Arab states until very recently. Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Michel Aflaq, the founder of the Ba'ath Party, was from a Christian background, and many other names can be mentioned in this connection. Turkey, on the other hand, having lost its empire, was developing Turkish nationalism. So the idea was, well, we've lost the empire, so Turkey must be now for the Turks. This is one of the explanations for Turkish hostility to other ethnic groups, whether they are Christian or Kurdish or whatever they may be. Rightly or wrongly, but we have to understand this. It's kind of being pushed into a corner, having lost your empire. Where will you go? You can't go back to the steppes of Central Asia again, from where they had, of course, originally come. Indian Muslim nationalism grew because of the fear that if India achieved independence, it would have an inbuilt Hindu majority, and the Muslims would be reduced to a permanent minority and remain without power. I think some of the intransigence of the Indian nationalist leaders led to the birth of Pakistan, but the vision behind Pakistan was not a theocratic one. It was actually a nationalist one. It was about culture, it was about language, it was about institutions like schools and universities and so on. It was taken over by the theocrats at a later stage. Now, these nationalisms began to be challenged from about the 1950s by various visions of Islamism. And Islamism, whether Shia or Sunni, began to accuse the nationalists of being a Western import, which to some extent they were. I mean, the Ba'ath Party was consciously modeled on the European fascism of the 1930s. The Islamists had negative views, obviously, of Western colonialism. And they wanted to purge the Islamic world of all of the vestiges, including nationalism, that colonialism may have left behind. So I think that is a powerful driver, both of the writings of Sayyid Qutb and Abul Ala Maududi, the two great ideologues in Egypt and Pakistan of Sunni Islamism, certainly. Secondly, the experience of what you might call neo-colonialism was also an occasion for Islamist rhetoric and action. The Suez Crisis, for instance, of 1956 was used to show that the West could never be the friend of Muslims. And in Iran, the destabilizing of a moderately socialist government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh by the West, because it wouldn't give Western powers oil concessions, and the return to power of the Shah was the seed that was sown in the 1950s, and the harvest was reaped in 1979 at the time of the Iranian Revolution. So what we do today will have consequences in the future, is what I'm saying. Thirdly, the failure of both command economy and capitalism in the Muslim world. So the command economy was tried in places like Egypt and Syria, with the usual results, you know, shoddy goods being produced that nobody wanted to buy, hidden unemployment, lack of opportunity for people to progress, stultification of the social orders, but you know what happens. But capitalism also failed. I mean, I remember talking to a World Bank official whilst working with very poor people in Pakistan, and he said to me, and these are his very words, he said, "We only know the rich, and we only work with the rich. We hope that what we do with the rich will trickle down to the poor." I said, well, at that time, I couldn't see any evidence of this happening. But that's what he claimed. Now, to be fair, the World Bank has changed a great deal since those days. But it shows the kind of bankruptcy of capitalism in addressing the needs of a particular country. In Iran, the Shah was building Switzerland with the oil revenues in North Tehran. And the people living in the slums of South Tehran were forbidden to go there. So when the revolution came, what happened? The people marched from South Tehran to North Tehran and hung the people living there from the lampposts. And that's what happened. Of course, these are occasions for Islamism to become influential and to achieve power. There are certain features of Islamism that are fundamental to it, that don't depend on circumstances. And in Sunni Islamism, for instance, the restoration of the caliphate is an obvious example, abolished by the Allied powers of the defeat of Turkey and by Kemal Atatürk, the secular ruler of Turkey. But ever since its abolition, Sunni Islam has wanted its restoration, even moderate people, because they need it for the way in which their religion is structured. The caliph is needed to provide a focus for the unity of the ummah, which is transnational. You see, the Muslim ummah is one people, all the Muslims in the whole world. And this is why you get people from Britain or Western Europe born and raised here who will go to Syria to fight, because it is in the cause of the ummah. The enforcement of Sharia as the Islamists understand it, that is to say, without reference to historical developments in the Sharia in different cultures at different times. The enforcement of Sharia implies also the return of the dhimma, the way in which non-Muslims are to be treated. And this is what exactly what is happening now in Mesopotamia and in Syria. And then the final sort of item on the agenda is the return of lands lost to Islam. Which are they? The Iberian Peninsula, India, I mean, you know, you name it. There are many issues of justice and injustice in the Holy Land, for example, and I'm fully conscious of them. I will be facing them right up here in a few days' time, so I'm thinking about them. But one element which cannot be ignored in the situation in the Holy Land is that this was a land that had been conquered by Islam and is now no longer ruled by Muslims. Now, until that issue is tackled, there will be no solution to the problem. May I have 5 more minutes? I think we lost a few minutes. Okay. Just to outline some issues. Now, out of all of this, there are some issues that arise which I would like you to consider. One is the relationship of religion to the state. One of the things that Islamism has done successfully is to put paid to the Westphalian consensus, which was the separation of the state and religion, which was the consigning of religion to the private sphere and so on. That will never happen again, at least in our own lifetime. The world now has to deal with religion in the public space, positively or negatively. And the question is, how are we going to do it? What is the relationship of religion to public life? Some years ago, I conducted a written dialogue with the then Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Pakistan on this issue. And he said in his written submission that the purpose of an Islamic state is to persuade people to be good Muslims, not to force them. Well, I could live with that, but that, of course, is not the experience of people. I mean, the experience is not just of persuasion, but of coercion. So if the role of religion in public life is to be that of persuasion, that's quite a different thing from forcing people to behave in this or that way. Secondly, the question about democracy. Democracy is not about achieving power at the ballot box, but giving it up. And Islamist movements, as far as they are concerned, and where democracy is concerned, the jury is out on that one. So if achieving power is the manifest victory of Islam, as they say, fath mubin, what would losing power be then? You know, what kind of models are there for dealing with this question? I had a very distinguished teacher who was also an Anglican bishop, as it happens, Bishop Kenneth Cragg, who's regarded as one of the most sympathetic students of Islam by the Muslim world as well as by Christians. And he was once asked, Bishop, you know, you're a very sympathetic student of Islam and all that, but in the end, what is the difference? What's the difference? And Bishop Kenneth thought about this for a while and then said, the difference is in the attitude to power. Islam believes that you change the world by taking power. Christianity teaches that you change the world by giving it up. And this is a difference that has to be worked out in polity, I mean, not just in religion. But then also, democracy is not enough. I was continually saying this with the situation in Egypt a few years ago, but we may also have to say it here in this country. Democracy can simply mean the tyranny of the majority. Yeah? That is no less tyranny because it is of the majority, whatever that majority may be. So you need certain safeguards. I mean, in this country, for example, I believe we need safeguards that recognize conscience and reasonable accommodation more and more. In Egypt, what was needed was a Bill of Rights that upheld, whatever else happened with the new Egyptian constitution, that upheld equality of all before the law, one law for all, co-citizenship, etc. The new Egyptian constitution has many of those things. It is not a perfect document, and I have some arguments with it still, but it has gone some way towards meeting those requirements, if you like. The relationship then of religion to law. In the West, as you know, law has developed both under Christian influence. A very senior Supreme Court judge in this country wrote to me the other day saying, "Of course, Bishop, our laws are based on the Ten Commandments and on our Lord's summary of them." I said hallelujah to that, but I do wish that her judgments reflected this belief more accurately. You probably know who I'm talking about now. So, of course, there's been that influence in a variety of ways, but in the West, the law has also developed a certain autonomy, which is separate from any particular religious tradition. And so it should be. One of the reasons why I and some other people had to oppose what the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time, Rowan Williams, and the Lord Chief Justice of the time said about Sharia being recognized in terms of public law in this country. One of the reasons was that there is a basic contradiction between the Western traditions of law, which proceed on the assumption of equality, and Sharia, which is based on inequality. So even Islamic scholars will tell you that the three great inequalities in Sharia are between Muslim and non-Muslim, between women and men, and between slave and free. Well, maybe that's not so relevant today, but the other two are. And when these distinguished gentlemen said, "Oh, we are not talking about amputation of hands and beheading people and so on," well, of course they weren't. "We are talking," they said, "about family law." Well, let's look at family law. A man can divorce a woman, but it is very difficult for a woman to divorce a man under Sharia. You try it and see. One of the things that impresses Muslim women so often about the teaching of Jesus is his teaching on marriage and the lifelong nature of marriage, which, of course, they have no experience of, with the continual threat of divorce. Custody of children. At the very same time as the Lord Chief Justice was saying that Sharia family law should be recognized in this country in terms of public law, the law lords were having one of their last sittings before they transmuted themselves into the Supreme Court. And the custom used to be that the bishop on duty sat with them when they ruled on various appeals. Well, I happened to be the bishop on duty in the House of Lords at that time, so I was sitting with them, and the question was of a Lebanese woman threatened with deportation. And they ruled in her favor, saying that if she was deported to the Lebanon, under Sharia, her son would be taken from her and given to her husband, and this would be a violation of her right to family life. At the very same time as the Lord Chief Justice was saying, let us recognize Sharia in terms of public law in this country. I mean, you know. Having said that, as I have indicated, and maybe we can develop this further in the discussion, in the course of history, the way in which Sharia has developed does give us room in Islamic countries, for instance, to consider not only its development and not only its limitations, but even its remaking altogether. The two great scholars who have contributed to the role of Sharia in modern states in the 20th century were both Christians. Sir Norman Anderson, who was the chair of the House of Laity of the General Synod of the Church of England, and Chief Justice A.R. Cornelius, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Pakistan. So Christians have certainly contributed to thinking about how Sharia can be rethought or limited or developed or, you know, whatever terms you want to use. And it is certainly possible to do that. One of the problems that Islamism has posed is a rejection of any attempt to deal with Sharia in this way. The one other issue that has to be considered is the relationship between thinking about jihad and the limitation on jihad. For instance, in the 19th century, many Muslim scholars began to say that jihad was only lawful in defending Islam when it was in danger. So when the Wahhabis launched a jihad against British rule in India, many Muslims said this jihad was unlawful because Islam was not in danger. The British Empire included in it perhaps the most Muslims that any empire ever has. But today the question is whether in dialogue we can agree those circumstances where armed conflict is justifiable in a world where we are not going to see conventional war so much, but non-conventional interventions for various reasons to prevent genocide, for example. I mean, this is a live question in Iraq and Syria at the moment by the international community. If Muslims and Christians could agree on when such conflict is justifiable, authorized by the international community, this would be a great boon for world peace and peacemaking and peacekeeping, for instance. Finally, reciprocity. You remember my conversation with the Saudi official. We have mosques in Europe and America and Australia, and you've got many in Southampton. No churches in Saudi Arabia, no Christian worship allowed. Why not? I've given you the example of Iran, and these can be multiplied in many different countries. I have experience of this in Egypt and Pakistan also. But what I've been concerned about is not to think of reciprocity in terms of tit for tat, you know. You have this, we want that. I think that would be a regrettable way of thinking about reciprocity. Rather, the way in which I have commended reciprocity is in the course of dialogue for Christians and Muslims to commit themselves to a common defense of fundamental freedoms. And in the dialogue with Al-Azhar in Egypt, the premier place of Sunni learning, we have made some headway on this question, and particularly on the question of apostasy, for example, and the punishments related to that. I think that is the way forward if we can, through dialogue, achieve some of these things, fundamental freedoms, some view of the justifiability of conflict in certain situations, whether that is in defense of Muslims in Bosnia or of Christians and Yazidis in Iraq. If we can do that, then dialogue will be of some use. I'm not a believer in kissy-kissy dialogue, where, you know, we pat each other on the back and say how wonderful we are, but in addressing these hard contemporary questions. So thank you very much. You've been very patient indeed. I look forward to your response.
Well, Michael, you've given us an enormous amount to think about and a wonderful historical overview to explain where we're at now and the sheer complexities of it all. I could imagine the questions we have today will be how it relates to us now, and I hope we will use the time well. So I took my children, some of my grandchildren, to the Victory this week, and one of the sailors who answers all your questions there said to them, there's only one silly question, and that is the question you're too afraid to ask. So just bear that in mind. If you've got a question that you want to ask, there's almost certainly other people in the room will say, yeah, that's what I'd like to know. So please, if you would like to join me, we'll put Tim guarding the microphone. If you abuse it, he'll hit you over the head with it. He's quite a violent man. And if we can sort of have a relatively ordered queue. Thank you, Richard. Would you like to go to the mic?
Actually, I've got a question.
You've got a question.
Am I allowed? May I have one of these chairs and then I can sit while people are... Because I've been standing while you've all been... I mean, you may all want to stand.
Yeah, do stand for a minute. Let's do that. Stretch your...
Thank you. Bless you. Bless you. Thank you.
Right.
Michael, you've used the term Islamism. Could you explain what you mean using that word?
Yes, I mean, there are problems with any term that we use, but what I think we have to do is to distinguish among three things. One is Muslims. Muslims are our neighbors, they are our fellow citizens, they are my relatives, they may not be yours, but I have many relatives who are Muslims. And as Christians, we are called to love them and to serve them and to witness to them. There should be no argument about that whatsoever. Secondly, there's the religion of Islam. As Christians, we should respectfully study any other system of belief, even when we disagree with it, perhaps particularly when we disagree with it. And I've tried to do that in much of my life. But then thirdly, there is what you might call a comprehensive political, social, economic, and religious ideology. The nearest parallel to this ideology is Marxism. Well, we all know what happened to Marxism. But I think when I use the word Islamism, that is the sort of thing I mean, a comprehensive ideology that is based on a religious vision and tradition, but is not the same as it.
Please do get to the mic as you've formed a queue there. That would be very helpful.
Hi, Michael. You mentioned Sunnis and Shias. In terms of reconciliation, would you adopt different approaches when talking to them? And also, could you comment about where we are in terms of having any reconciliation in terms of how we live, co-live with them?
Reconciliation? Sorry, I didn't get the last.
How we, in the approach in terms of trying to reconcile co-living with them, if that's the right way of putting it.
Yes, I'm sorry that I have not been able to give more attention to the Shia in this talk. They're certainly worthy of it. Many of the features, of course, of Islam, whether Shia or Sunni, are in common. But there are differences. I mean, the Shia almost always have a tradition of a living authority. So it is not just about the Quran and the Sunnah, but there is usually either an imam or the representative of an imam who wields authority in a way that Sunni Islam does not have. There is also, I was in Iran last month, and there is a kind of lively eschatological expectation about Shia Islam that generally doesn't exist in Sunni Islam. I know that Daesh or ISIS has revived this kind of eschatological expectation, but in Shia Islam, I mean, for instance, it is impossible to understand the foreign or military policy of the Iranian nation without understanding Shia eschatology. That is to say, the war in Iraq, I was in Iran at the time, thousands of barely teenagers they were pushed to the front. They were given green keys to paradise, plastic, made out of plastic. Didn't know you could get into paradise with plastic keys, but there we are. I mean, it's tragic. They were cannon fodder. But the whole thing was justified on the basis that this would hasten the coming of the imam and his rule of justice. You see. Now, if the West doesn't understand this, then it will continually misunderstand and misapply what's going on between the West and Iran, for example. But that's also true of other nations. So that, I would certainly say, this eschatological aspect of Shia Islam is one that we need to keep in mind. There are other things. I mean, in terms of Christian witness, the Shia have an understanding of suffering, the place of suffering in the world and in the experience of people, which can lead to talking about the cross, for instance, more easily than with Sunnis.
Bishop, thank you very much for your very interesting talk. Can I just ask, what would you say in reply or in response to somebody who says Islam is a religion of peace?
Well, any religion can become a religion of peace. Depends on what they do. If you are talking about the etymology, then to say Islam means peace is incorrect. It doesn't mean that. It means a submission or surrender. We can't base anything on false etymology, certainly. Islam is quite different from Christianity in its origins, in how it expanded. I've explained to you all of the things that happened at that time and in subsequent centuries. The question now is what Muslim countries and the Islamic world will do. I mean, take the traditional division in Sharia between the Darul Islam, the house of Islam, and the Darul Harb, the house of conflict or war, so that the obligation of Muslims is to extend the Darul Islam so that it extends into the Darul Harb and the whole world becomes Darul Islam. I mean, that's the kind of classical way of understanding things. Now, if you have only that, then of course you have perpetual conflict. Historically, to limit this, certain things have happened. For instance, there has been a recognition that there are some territories that are Darul Sul, where there is peace between Muslims and non-Muslims. Maybe a peace that has been signed into a treaty of some kind or a covenant of some kind. Sometimes there is only Hudna, which is a temporary truce rather than a treaty of peace. All of that is good, but the Islamic world, to my mind, does not yet have a doctrine of international relations based on peaceful diplomacy. It does not have it yet. I think it is urgent for Islamic scholars to develop this out of concepts like Darul Sul and the recognition that where Islam is allowed to be practiced or where it is tolerated is not Darul Harb. I mean, there are elements in the tradition that could lead to such conclusions. The question is, will they or will the Islamists' logic prevail?
Thank you very much. In looking at the life of Muhammad, it seems that you showed a range of ways of Islam relating to other religions that went from peaceful coexistence early on to conflict later on. And I have heard it said that this is reflected within the Quran itself, that verses about peaceful coexistence are earlier than later verses about conflict, and that Muslim theologians will argue from a principle of abrogation that the later verses override the earlier verses, just as Christians might say something that Jesus said about the nature of divorce in the New Covenant overrides the nature of divorce under the Mosaic Law. So they would say this principle of abrogation means that the conflict model of relationship overrides the earlier peaceful coexistence model. My question to you is that the case? Does that have to be the case within Muslim theology? And if so, what then are the prospects for Muslim Christian relationship?
Thank you. Very good question. I think just to say something about Jesus and the Mosaic Law, Jesus is the fulfilling of the law. When the New Testament says he's the end of the law, that doesn't mean end in the sense of something that is then no longer valid, but as one who fulfills the meaning of the law. And I think this is certainly the case with Jesus' teaching on marriage. I mean, that's, you know, that is not an irrelevant matter at this time, that Jesus' teaching on marriage is the fulfilling of God's purposes for man and woman and for human sexuality in general. So, I mean, it's not, there is not a contradiction, but a fulfilling. But coming to your real question, yes, the Quran and Islam certainly has a doctrine of abrogation, but there is an early Meccan surah which is called Al-Kafirun, the unbelievers, in which there is a verse, Lakum dainikum wali dini, to you your religion and to me mine. Now you may say that was abrogated, but there is a late Medinan surah, Surah Al-Baqarah, which says, La ikraha fi deen, there is no compulsion in religion. So what's been abrogated? You know, I mean, I think that's the kind of question that needs to be asked. There are some very interesting Muslim scholars, Abdullah An-Na'im, the Sudanese scholar, follower of Mahmud Taha, who was executed for apostasy, by the way, who is now saying that What we need in Islam is abrogation in reverse. So authentic Islam is Meccan Islam, according to him and others like him. In Medinan Islam, what you have is a running commentary on the affairs of the Prophet of Islam and of the Muslim community, which is not necessarily determinative for the nature of Islam. I think this is a very important point that An-Na'im is making. And if his view and that of others like him prevails, then we could be dealing precisely with what you had mentioned as the earlier period, if that turns out to be the determinative one.
Bishop Michael, thank you for the very detailed and thoughtful and eloquent overview you gave us of 1,400 years of relationship between Christianity and Islam. Now, for the best part of that time, the norm across the world was that people had a faith. And perhaps one of the interesting developments of the 20th century, particularly coming out of the Enlightenment, was the emergence of a new norm in the West especially, where atheism and secularism are a third front in that interaction. Now, Christianity has had its own fascinating interactions with that stream of thought and the areas of apologetics which we engage in very lively debates around modern issues of interpreting the Bible and how that spills over into applied theology for issues around homosexuality, women in leadership, abortion, euthanasia, etc., etc. It's interesting to see the emergence of some of those ideas and thoughts in the Islamic world, and we see various extremes from recent negotiation to the abhorrent execution of atheist bloggers in Pakistan recently. Would you comment, perhaps, on the difference between those two, how Christianity is engaging with that intellectual school of secular thought and how Islam is? I suppose the question, in essence, is can Islam engage with those intellectual challenges and stand up to that intellectual scrutinization in the same way that modern Christianity is struggling to?
Yes, I think the bloggist was in Bangladesh, wasn't he? Not in Pakistan. There has not been that engagement with secular thought in the Islamic world as there has been in Christianity, except in some places like Turkey. I mean, I think in Turkey, because the ideology of the Turkish state is secular, there has been quite a lot of discussion in Turkey about the relationship of religion, certainly to secular polity, if not to secular ideas. But there are writers in Turkey who are secular, as indeed there are in Bangladesh. I mean, one of the reasons why this man was murdered was the fear of the Islamists about a growing secular lobby. Now, one of the tendencies in the Islamic world, which I deplore, and I've often said this, is to silence people with whom you do not agree. I mean, this is also the case here, where I've always said, look, if you don't agree with someone, the thing is to answer them, not to try and silence them. I mean, that is the way of totalitarianism. I mean, I'm sorry to say that nowadays we are seeing some of that totalitarianism in secularity itself, where there is a desire to suppress discussion rather than to reply to it. So in whichever way it arises, I think we must encourage, and this, of course, is one of the reasons for dialogue, is dialogue between people of different views to better understand one another and to come to some conclusion which, if not an agreement, at least some guarantee of fundamental freedoms. For example, freedom of speech, of belief, of the right to change your belief. In the new Egyptian constitution, some of this is guaranteed, but not all of it. So there is an incremental, there is an incremental improvement, but not a total one. I think the challenge of secularism, of course the Enlightenment was both Christian and secular, in that sense, But the challenge of secularism can only arise in the Islamic world if there is freedom of speech and expression. And we must work for that because that is how people will come to the truth. That is how they will come to a reliable estimate of themselves and of others and of the world. And as Christians, we should be committed to that, of course.
Firstly, Bishop, thank you for your illuminating talk and also for the work that you do around the world promoting the Lord Jesus in the most difficult circumstances. My question is really, during the historical discussion we've had and you've given us, you've mentioned around the world there have been a number of treaties and agreements with Islam over the years. I've heard, and I wondered for your comment about it, that the Islamic thought of us is infidel, and therefore they can make treaties and with impunity actually break them at will, because they can quote the Quran and say that they don't need to actually engage, and that any word made between Muslim and Muslim is good, but between a Muslim and a non-Muslim isn't binding. Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah, I mean, there is the notion of taqiyya, which is dissimulation, either to defend oneself from persecution or to achieve some advantage for Islam. I mean, that is a part of Islamic doctrine. It is not used all the time, but it is there. And in Shia Islam, it is used more often because the Shia as a minority have used it to hide themselves. I mean, this is why I say that the true extent of Shia demography is not known. And we will only gradually, as this conflict sharpens, come to realize what the extent of that demography is. So I think there is that. But the real problem is not taqiyya, I think, in this case, but the absence of a doctrine of international relations that is based on peace rather than the cessation of conflict, if you see what I mean. I mean, you know, you can have a ceasefire, you can have a truce, you can even have a treaty for a duration. But at the moment, as far as I know, I stand to be corrected, Islam has no doctrine of a perpetual peace between nations. And that is, I think it's possible for Islamic scholars, I'm not an Islamic scholar, but I think from my point of view, it is possible for Islamic scholars to develop such a doctrine, and they need to do so urgently.
You're obviously doing some great work with in terms of dialogue with the various Islamic groups. But do you think there is any hope at all of dialogue with ISIS?
Any opportunities?
Oh, it's gone.
Yes, I mean, the short answer is no. But there are extremists. Groups. I mean, not all extremist groups are violent, by the way. There are extremist types of Islam that are that profess nonviolence anyway. I was the Bishop of Raiwind, as you said, in Pakistan, and Raiwind is not known for very much, except that it is the center for the International Islamic Missionary Movement of the Tablighi Jamaat, you know, the people who wanted to build the mega mosque. And our situation with them was, we said to them, we understand that your commitment is to call people to Islam, the dawah, you know, the invitation to Islam. You need to understand that our commitment is to call people to faith in Jesus Christ. Having said that, of course we can work for the good of the community, and we can learn from one another. And to some extent, this was possible. I remember getting up to preach and finding that There were a few rows of Islamic trainee missionaries sitting in the church, perhaps come to learn how to preach, but probably how not to preach. those kinds of things are possible. I have had a very difficult, but nevertheless very real dialogue with the Islamic regime in Iran. I value that very much. I don't expect them to agree with me. They don't. But sometimes, for the sake of the Christians, we do get some way forward in what is done. And that cannot be minimized. I've had dialogue for a long time with the Jamaat-e-Islami, which is an Islamist organization in Pakistan, hugely influential in the world. But I think where there is the kind of violence that ISIS is engaged in, I can't see how there can be dialogue with such a group. It may be that some people in due course, if they survive that long, will begin to see that this is not the way of Islam itself. It is not the way in which human beings are supposed to relate to one another and will want to talk. Well, if they do, of course, one should be willing to talk to anyone. But at the moment, I haven't myself picked up any inclination to do so.